Today is March the 10th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.fm on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. TCF 2021, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival, the original Personal Computer Festival. The festival this year goes virtual on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. The event is free attendance via Zoom teleconferencing. The keynote speaker for the event is Jerry Foster, who is the Chief Technology Officer and co-founder of Plex Systems. His keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force with an eye towards its significant positive impact on our world. Jerry Foster built a custom, innovative, cloud-based business process management software system. Today, the company employs more than 500 employees globally. Jerry continues to set the pace of the innovation in the cloud, leading the company's technology strategy and research initiatives that drives the industry forward. In this day and age, there are technology buzzwords that many have a hard time coming up with a definition. More importantly, there is very little coverage about what companies have actually used and brought the technologies to the market. I had the opportunity to interview Jerry Foster for an upcoming broadcast on the Personal Computer Show, and I asked,
who is Plex?
Plex is a software company in Southeast Michigan, just outside of Detroit, headquartered here, although we have offices and engineering organizations around the world. But we make manufacturing software. Traditionally, it's called ERP or MES software. And we got our start here in Southeast Michigan in the automotive industry. We cut our teeth in a forging factory about 25 years ago. We started and we built a information system for this forging company. And it really helped this forging company to excel and to really move ahead of the pack and as they supplied Ford and GM. And we built this system to run the entire facility. Everything from incoming raw material to production and inventory control, to tooling, to gauges and shipping and everything in between, accounting. And we built it for this forging company, and all of our customers and suppliers would come in and they'd say, this is awesome. Can I get this? Can I buy this? How do I get my hands on this? And after a while, we were like, maybe we should sell this. Break out. And so April Fool's Day of 1995, April 1st, we broke off from that forging company and became our own software company and started selling the ERP software, MES software, and have been growing like gangbusters ever since. So
you mean you had to pick a date, April 1st?
I know. I don't know why we picked that date. It's been so long. My memory is a bit fuzzy. I had hair back then, and I don't remember why, but that was the date. So, but I do know this. It's easy to remember the date. We don't ever forget it.
Yes, it is. Yes, indeed. I have a question for you, though. With this pandemic, is your model a template, or you actually customize it for each company that you do the business with?
So we are a shared multi-tenant system, which means and we are in the cloud. And so we rebuilt our software from the ground up in the cloud in 2000. So we're one of the pioneers in putting enterprise business in the cloud. And so because of that, all of our customers run off the same code base, and being a shared multi-tenant system, they have the same interface. So we do some customizations, but for the most part, it is a software package that our customers use. It's a template piece of software that our customers run their business with.
Well, I was on your website and I got the impression that, you're really in the business of business intelligence. And I was surprised to see an ice cream factory.
Yeah. Yeah, but Jenny's Ice Cream, terrific product, by the way. We love them. So yeah, we cut our teeth in automotive, but automotive can be quite cyclical. even before the recent events, you know, with some of the tariff issues and the pandemic. So a number of years ago, we started to look at what are the industries that were similar that we could tackle. And it was interesting that the food and beverage industry has a lot of similarities in their traceability requirements that we had with our automotive customers. And so we started branching into food and beverage, and then we have a large number of food and beverage customers now, including Jenny's Ice Cream, because the software works. We had to make some tweaks and some changes, of course, but for the most part, we've been very successful moving into our food and beverage space.
You know, during this past year with the pandemic, had companies had to come to you to say, we have to make some quick changes and tweaks, and because the workforce is not there anymore or the supply is different?
Yeah, definitely. It was a very challenging year. And this is one of the times where the benefits of cloud really, really shone through. It just put a spotlight on the difference between a cloud-based infrastructure for your critical business applications versus on-premise. So our customers who are all in the cloud, because we're in the cloud, so our customers are in the cloud. When this hit, most of our customers were designated critical functionality. At least they could employ some of the critical personnel in the plant, but they still had to send most of their personnel home. But they were still able to function, because all of the workers could do their jobs from home. They could log into the system and do everything they needed to do from home. And then management could still view the analytics, the reports, the functions of the plant. They could, from wherever they were at, they could see what was going on. So our customers were able to actually function quite well, relatively speaking, in the middle of the pandemic. And in addition, we had a number of customers, because of the cloud-based infrastructure, they were able to pivot. A number of them started making, sanitizers. A lot of our alcohol, food and beverage customers started making sanitizers. We had customers pivot to making PPE, and some of them making ventilator parts. And they were able to do that because of the cloud-based platform, allowed them to pivot quite quickly. It was interesting. We have some of our bigger customers have most of their plants using Plex in the cloud, but some of their plants have not transitioned over yet, and we're using some of our competitors' on-premise systems, and they said the difference between the two was night and day. It's like the on-premise systems went dark. They didn't know what was happening there, and you had to use a telephone to find out what was going on. So it was really interesting to see our customers go through that transition and watch them come through. Manufacturers are a hardy bunch. They've been through a lot. They're just an incredible bunch of people. And it was really cool and to see them come through that the way we did.
When you implement a system such as this, you really have two different tiers of people you work with. One is the management. And of course, to convince the management, this is the way to go. But how do you get the working staff to agree to changes?
Yeah, so that's always an exercise in change management, right? So on one hand, if you've built software that's easily accessible and usable and pleasant to use, it's a much easier story. Because to be honest with you, a lot of the workers on the shop floor, they don't really know or care that the system is in the cloud or not. Because to them, there's not a flashing button that says I'm in the cloud. It's just a piece of software that they're using. It's just a browser-based interface. And so to them, it's relatively easy to use. So for the management, they have just a traditional change management exercise. If they're making changes to their software, to get their users and their workers to make those changes. And that just comes down to being open, being honest, treating your employees like valued members of the team. When we look at our customers and the ones that have had the most success in change management, they include their employees every step of the way. They don't tell them this is what's happening. They set up proof of concepts. They set up testing rooms. They set up places for them to actually engage with the software and to get used to it in advance. They include them in the planning meetings. They do all sorts of things like that to include their employees. And that really has a huge benefit in that change management process.
Is your software adaptable to mergers and acquisitions in terms of incorporating other organizations into the company?
Yes, it is. We've had a number of our customers that have done just that, have acquired and merged with other customers. And that's fairly common, especially in the automotive industry and food and beverage as well. So we've had a number of customers go through that and just absorb a company and be able to bring them onto the platform relatively easily.
I built many systems similar to what you have, except that it wasn't tied into a cloud. So I understand the nature of the kind of work you do. But have you thought about in any way taking your model and downscaling it into small businesses?
We have. You know, what's interesting is when you talk about ERP, enterprise resource planning, it's a big thing, right?
It's a big word.
It's a big word. And so for 15, 20 years, that's what we've done is ERP. But as the cloud has become more prolific and people are using and businesses are using the cloud, they're starting to choose best of breed applications. I'm going to use this HR system and this CRM system and this MES system. That's a bunch of acronyms there, but I'm going to use these for various parts of my system. I'm going to choose the best one and then integrate them. So we've actually started to deconstruct the product so that it is more palatable in that environment. So we've built out a quality system. We've built out a supply. We've actually acquired a company to do supply chain planning. We've built our own IoT system, and they all work together, but you can buy them all separately. Our manufacturing execution system, which is just the component that runs on the shop floor. So we have definitely deconstructed the product to work in that environment that you alluded to.
When you talk about the cloud, do you use a public cloud or hybrid cloud or a pure private cloud?
So all of the above, and here's why. So when we first started, there was no such thing as public cloud. In 2000, there was, so we had to build our own public cloud infrastructure. So we built our own data centers and all of the technology that goes along with that, we built it. And there was no template. We were flying by the seat of our pants. So we became not only experts in building manufacturing software, but experts in running cloud-based data centers. And so the majority of our customer base runs on a cloud-based data center that we provide. However, in the last couple of years, the last few years, as Azure and AWS and Google have increased their competencies, we have gotten to the point where, our core business is manufacturing software. And so we've started to transition parts of our business over to public cloud. And as we build in brand new functionality and brand new modules, our first look is, can we build this in public cloud first and integrate as opposed to continuing that in our data center? We would like to eventually move to using public cloud just because of the advantages of scale that Amazon and Microsoft can provide now that they couldn't before. That being said, you mentioned hybrid. We were 100% in the cloud, but we just recently acquired a company, just made the announcement last week, Coors Engineering. And what Coors provides is that we call it the first mile, which is actually the connectivity right down to the PLCs and the sensors and the machines on the shop floor. So we now actually have the entire story from the cloud-based enterprise part of it all the way down to connecting to the components and the sensors on the shop floor in a hybrid environment.
One of the things that I always been talking about on the air is backup, 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 and trying to convince people to back up like they might. Why do I have to do it? And what do you tell them? You have retention cycles, you have backup, you have recovery. And yeah. How do you assure them that it is a secure system?
So we a couple things. One, and we actually walk them through here's our retention cycle. Here's here's our backup plans. Here's where it's stored. Here's the number of places that we store it in. And here is the all the various certifications that we have acquired to make sure we secure data. And one of the things that we use to convince them is, we do this for a living. So it's kind of a misnomer for people to think, well, on-premise data is more secure, because not only do you have bad actors very potentially inside of your company, but if you're connected to the internet in any way, even if your software is running on-premise, you're at risk. And so we have over the years built an incredible amount of security into our application, into our infrastructure. It's what we do. This is our business. If we screw up here, we're in big trouble. So we have an entire cloud ops group that is dedicated around backup security. We have a chief security officer, and it's all she does. It's all she thinks about 24/7. And that's one of the, we talk to our potential customers and say, do you have a chief security officer? Well, no. What's your backup structure? Well, we sometimes back up once a week, you know? And so we start to ask those questions and then show them what we do. And it's not real hard to convince them anymore that we're the real deal when it comes to a secure strong system for them to entrust us with their data.
Has any of your customers been concerned with the increase in ransomware?
Yeah, in fact, we were on a customer call most of the day today, and in the middle of that call, someone mentioned, "Hey, we're dealing with some ransomware attack today, a big one apparently hit." I haven't had a chance to look into it yet, but they are concerned. But that would mostly affect their any on-premise systems they have. Of course, we have built all security structures in place to prevent that. And so they are concerned, but again, it's just one of those things that you do the best you can to make sure we are secure and go from there.
Can the tech support that you provide get to the customer site when it's needed in this pandemic area?
Yeah, so most of the tech support we provide, we have usually not needed to get to the plant even before the pandemic. We do most of our support remotely. But there are cases where we've had to adjust, usually not in the case of support, but in the case of implementation. So when we get a new customer, we would in the past send a team to their facility to learn everything about their business and to meet with them and to walk around the plant and start to put a plan together to implement our software at their facility. So that part has had to change. We had to learn how to do that remotely. We've had to learn how to use things like GoPros and cameras and video and that sort of thing to actually replace being on site. We actually also have one of our customers. This is kind of interesting. We haven't done this, but it's similar to the question you just asked. One of our customers is actually using a Microsoft HoloLens augmented reality device. So what they do is their workers at the factory are wearing this Microsoft HoloLens while the support staff is at the headquarters. And so the worker at the plant will walk around, they'll be able to communicate real time. And did you check that gauge? And I need you to flip this lever. And they can do it real time with the person at home or at the, you know, even at home, seeing what the worker is seeing real time through their eyes. It's really, really cool to see that happen. And that would have only happened with some of this new technology coming out with Industry 4.0 and augmented reality. And so yeah, they're doing some really cool stuff.
Plex is probably one of the leaders in this area. Where do you see Plex two years from now, 5 years from now?
Yeah, so I see us just continuing to expand. As far as us personally, I see a couple things. One, as far as the business is concerned, we have some real opportunities in Europe and Asia and overseas, really expanding our footprint and expanding the industries that we serve, expanding our food and beverage, and really making Plex to be a force worldwide. We are one of the only ERP systems in the cloud, so we just want to continue to expand on that and leverage that advantage. From a technology standpoint, one of the things I do as a CTO is really try to find that intersection between manufacturing operations and technology, because I love playing with technology. You probably do as well, but there's no shortage of things I could play with, right? And so what I try to do and my team tries to do is take a real pragmatic approach to what are some of these new technologies coming out that could really make life easier for our manufacturing customers. For instance, one of the things that we're looking at right now is might blow your mind. It's a mind control device from a company called NextMind. And I founded the Consumer Electronics Show last year or 2 years ago. And you put this contraption on your head and you can manipulate computer software just by concentrating on specific buttons and portions of the screen.
Geez, so, something like I might want to use for my grandchildren, huh?
Yeah, exactly, right? But you can imagine a person in a shop floor facility, a person with some disabilities who can't use a keyboard or a mouse, being able to use something like that in a hands-free environment. So even though it seems really space age, we've connected that to a real live use case on the shop floor for our manufacturers. So that's kind of the cool things that we're looking at, 2 to 5 years out. What is a hands-free, disconnected environment look like on the shop floor? And what are the technologies that can support that?
It's interesting you say that, because the question I was going to ask is, how well does your model adapt to people that don't speak English?
Right. So, we have just like most enterprise software, we have all the various language packs and language capabilities for the software for our customers who don't speak English. But then we are utilizing technologies wherever possible to make that as easy as possible for those users.
Well, you know what? We're really looking forward to your keynote speech on March the 20th. Is it something common or is it really different between what you do at the business level as compared to the consumer level?
You know, I think there's the consumer level is often a leading indicator of some of these technologies. And augmented reality would be a good example of that. And that's why I go to something like the Consumer Electronics Show. And I walk around there and that's in Las Vegas. And there's literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of products that people are trying to get you to pay attention to. But looking through that, you can see what where the industries are going, what things are coming when it comes to like 3D printing and augmented reality. And then you can start to say, okay, these things are coming in the consumer world, which means in the business world, it's not far behind. So they're very closely related.
Well, you know what? You're full of information. And I'm sure that when you give the keynote speech, you're going to be really talking about why you love AI.
I am going to. Yep. It's amazing. I can't wait.
Well, you know what? Don't answer the question, but I'm going to ask you the first question, but you don't have to answer it now. In fact, don't answer it now. We'll wait to hear what you have to say. Is what are some of the myths in AI, and is it ready for prime time?
All right. All right, Hank. I will write that down and make sure I address those.
I thank you, Jerry, for taking the time to sit down with me out of your very busy schedule. I look forward to seeing you virtually on March the 20th. The website is tcf-nj.org for more information on the upcoming Trenton Computer Festival. Ideally, before buying a particular computer system, I want to be able to run it through its paces. When buying a computer system, the build, the fit and finish, and the tactile touch of the keyboard are important factors for me. If the purchase price is not dramatically more than from an online dealer, I would support the local dealer. Last week, I reported that Fry's is closing all their stores. Now Best Buy just laid off 5,000 workers and will close more stores. Best Buy expects 40% of its sales to come from online purchases this year, up from 19% 2 years ago, and the company said it needed to alter its workforce in response to this shift. Starting this month, Best Buy had been adjusting the mix of full-time and part-time employees in stores due to having too many full-time and not enough part-time employees. Best Buy laid off 5,000 employees, the majority of whom work full-time. It also said it is adding approximately 2,000 new part-time positions. Best Buy has around 102,000 employees. The company also said that it closed 20 of its big box stores in each of the past 2 years and expects to close a higher number this year. Best Buy has 450 store leases coming up for renewal in the next 3 years, and Best Buy said that there will be higher thresholds on renewing leases as they evaluate the role each store plays. The company has around 1,000 stores in the United States. Best Buy also plans to use more of its in-store space to fulfill home delivery orders. The retailer is piloting new store layouts that reduce the size of sales floors and expand the space dedicated to shipping orders. The company said it cut the jobs because more shoppers are choosing to buy online instead of coming inside its stores. It will replace the 5,000 full-time employees with 2,000 part-time workers. They also said it is paying hourly workers an additional cash gratitude bonus of $500 if full-time and $200 if part-time or occasional seasonal. Best Buy's workforce has shrunk in the last year after having to furlough workers when it closed stores to the public in the early days of the pandemic. It currently has more than 100,000 workers, down 21,000 or 17% from the year before. Employees started being brought back from furlough in mid-June. In August, the company raised its minimum starting pay to $15 an hour. The company is retraining workers to help with online orders, and more space in stores is being used to ship orders or to get them ready for curbside pickup, where shoppers buy online and pick up orders in the parking lot. Best Buy said its online sales soared 89% from November to the end of January compared with the same period a year ago. Revenue during that quarter grew 11% to $16.9 billion, and its profit rose nearly 10% to $816 million. As retail stores selling computer systems are shrinking, the day will come when we buy a computer system based only on promotional material. I think the term is buying a pig in a poke, something that is bought or accepted without knowing its value or seeing it first. At least when you buy a car today, you can always get to test drive it first before buying. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Pierce with questions on CRM software.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I give you some of my experience of being an IT professional, and these are things that can cross over from we've got big business, small business, even, you know, your at-home business, and even your personal usage. In this case, Pierce reached out to me, and he asked me about customer relationship management software. This is also called CRM, and CRM is a big, huge business. Now, Pierce used Goldmine for a long time. Now, it isn't working out for him as well as it used to. He's been dealing with a lot of technical support and things like that, and he's not happy with Goldmine. He's also not happy with the price for it. He pays, I think he said it was about $400 or $500 annually for the software. His concept is, I paid for it once. I don't want to have to keep paying over and over and over again, especially lots of money like this is. Now, there's a lot to cover here, and I'm going to do this as best I can. First off, there are many different systems out there. There are a number of different CRM software packages out there. Now, what CRM does is it allows you to track all of your customers, all of your potential customers, all of the different orders that they've done, and all of the different bits and pieces of information that are seemingly unrelated, tie them all together and keep track of all of the different contacts you've had as well with them, and also start plotting out your next contact with that same customer, that same person. I want you to think about it like this. This is a sales tool. This is something that salesmen use to track their entire business of dealing with customers. So let's say I have to talk to Larry. So I'm going to talk to Larry, and I'm going to note down some comments along the way. I'm going to, oh, he mentioned his wife's name. I'm going to note that down. Oh, his birthday's coming up in a month. Oh, you know, maybe I can call him for his birthday. We'll kind of figure out when his birthday is, or maybe, you know, maybe Larry will share it. And we note these different things in there. Larry's been talking about this, you know, widget ABC. All right, let's make notes of widget ABC. And there are a number of different things that you put in here. Because this is so large, because this is tracking so much information, it is a serious, serious platform. And it isn't in the same form that we might have our ERP software, our enterprise resource planning software, where it's all very much set and static and so forth. It has to be flexible. It has to be Most salespeople, no offense, I'm going to say this as gently as I can, most salespeople aren't really focused on the technology side of it. They want the software to kind of work around them, not them working around the software. So, with the size and volume of information that we're dealing with, As far as the salespeople really are dealing with it, this software, there are so many features, so many different flexible items that have to be built in, so many different prospecting and calendaring and notes and all of this that have to be shoved into this software that it winds up being expensive. It also winds up being expensive because there are a lot of competitors in the market that are also charging a lot for the software. So, price-wise, you're going to be stuck with that. You're also going to be stuck with, and this is kind of a leading edge of where we're going. Everybody has started to see that everything has become cloud-based. Everything is available on the internet. You go and you go to, in this case, I'm going to name a big, huge name in the CRM business. It's called Salesforce. So you'll go to salesforce.com and you'll log in and they've got all of the information there for you. They manage to keep that all up to date. They link in various bits and pieces of information outside sometimes to tie in, to help you out. And that's all great, but it means that it's constantly just evolving there. Now, because it's web-based, well, they're going to charge you a monthly fee. They're going to charge you, perhaps, an annual fee. We've seen this with the different little bits and pieces of fees that we're seeing all over the place. Yes, Microsoft Office. Yeah, you can go to Office 365 now, and it's like $100 a year, and you can actually have three different systems within your home on Office 365. Or maybe it's five, I don't remember, and there's a lot to that. Dropbox. You get a little free nibble, but if you want 2 terabytes or 3 terabytes, it's $15, $20 a month, a little bit less if you buy it annually. And that's a lot of how all of this is going. And, maybe you're not into that. Maybe you're into the same idea of more space for your cell phone, your smartphone, your iPhone. Well, they have an iCloud subscription. It adds 50 megs for $2 and a terabyte or whatever it is for a few bucks more. Look, it all starts to mount up. This is how they're locking us all into this monthly fee or annual fee, and it's all headed in that direction. Unfortunately for Pierce, this is a battle that he's going to lose. It's a battle we're all going to lose, and I think we're going to pay more for software over the long haul. Not the individual software packages, just the many that we decide are important to us. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Comcast upload speeds are hidden until you get to the last page of checkout. Comcast released a 2020 network performance data report with stats on how much internet usage rose during the pandemic. It said that upload use has grown faster than download use. Peak downstream traffic in 2020 increased approximately 38% over 2019 levels, and peak upstream traffic increased approximately 56% over 2019 levels. Upload use on Comcast network grew largely by video conferencing among people working and learning at home. The Xfinity website advertises cable internet plans with download speeds starting at 25 megabits per second, without mentioning that upstream speeds are just a fraction of the downstream ones. Comcast ordering system will show upload speeds after it checks whether your credit card is valid in the final page where you submit an order. This, however, does not help people who are signing up for service and want to know before signing up what the upload speeds are. The absence of upload speeds from Comcast's website just keeps the customers in the dark. Despite Comcast claiming that upstream speeds are included in your cart, the ordering page does not mention upload speeds. Comcast said the upload speeds will finally appear when you are at the step when you review your order. In the Comcast ordering system, after you submit your address, phone number, and credit card information, and click Next, this triggers a step in which Comcast system
checks if you had entered a valid credit card. It's only after you had entered a valid credit card number that you finally get to this page. Well, a third-party website, CableTV.com, lists both download and upload speeds, showing that Comcast's 25 megabits per second download plan comes with only a 3 megabits upload speed. The 100 megabits per second plan and 200 megabits second plan both have upload speeds of 5 megabits per second. Wow, that's quite slow. The 300 megabits per second download plan, the upload speed is only 10 megabits per second. And the 600 megabits per second plan, the upload speed is only 15 megabits per second. Comcast, you can increase that upload speed, or at least tell the customers what it is and not wait till they get to the end and without thinking is subscribing to your service and not really knowing what the upload speeds are. T-Mobile, they haven't learned what Verizon was telling people last week. T-Mobile has been busy selling its 5G network, and they've been spending a lot of money expanding it. And it makes this a head-scratcher that it's also been caught telling users to turn off the 5G to save battery life. Hey, didn't Verizon just make this same public relations misstep a few days ago? It sure did. But instead of learning from the example, T-Mobile appears to have pulled the same stunt, where Verizon told users to switch to LTE. Many of T-Mobile's support documents tell users to do the same thing, to go all the way back to 2G. In case you're not aware, switching to 2G will make your phone next to useless as a data device. The maximum theoretical speed you could get from a 2G connection would be around 1 megabits per second, though many top out at closer to 256 kilobits per second, which is 1/4 the speed. Even 1 megabits per second is 25 times slower than what the FTC considers to be acceptable broadband speeds, and 300 times slower than the average 5G mid-band speeds that T-Mobile has been bragging about. By the way, T-Mobile is also in the midst of phasing out the 2G signals for good. What's the appeal of USB flash drives? Well, there are two things that make USB flash drives appealing as storage devices. They are small and simple. You don't have a cable dangling from your laptop. I would offer one word of caution, though. External drives and cables might be annoying, but the connection is flexible and resilient. USB flash drives are small, but it's rigid, and with the connection sticking out, you can do some damage if you snap one off, not just only to the USB flash drive, but to the connecting port on your laptop, too. The other unknown with a USB flash drive is whether they are designed for continuous read-write operation over long periods. I imagine the cheapest might not be, but I would hope that the higher capacity, faster flash drives are made with expectation that they might be used for this purpose. Can you get a USB flash drive with enough capacity and speed? Yeah, the answer is yes and no. This depends entirely on what you need. You can get USB flash drives, 256 gigabyte or even larger capacities if you're willing to pay for it, a lot more than you might expect for such a small device. And if this is enough, then this is looking like a good solution. They do not, however, offer the capacity of portable hard drives or portable solid-state devices, which typically start at 500 gigabytes and up, and go up to 2 terabytes or more. The speed issue is even more important. If all you need is supplementary storage or backup, a USB flash drive could do a good job. The fastest offered read-write speeds fast enough for files you need all the time, so you could use one as a photo archive, for example, or for work in progress. The load and save times won't be as fast as a solid-state device. USB flash drives are unlikely to be fast enough, however, for video editing and playback, especially 4K. Yes, a USB flash drive can replace or supplement a solid-state drive. But while the fastest and best are starting to approach the speed and capacity of an external drive, they are not there yet. The danger is that you can end up with a storage device that's almost, but not quite big enough, and almost, but not quite fast enough, you have to be realistic about your needs. However, if your storage device on your computer is soldered onto the motherboard and cannot be removed, well, these USB flash drives can be a good supplement. There are three things that USB flash drives are good for. Swapping files with friends or colleagues. Speed and capacity aren't important, so just get a cheap one, and they can be really, really cheap. They could be used for emergency storage. You're away from home. Your laptop run out of space and you need to store some extra stuff quick. You have a good-sized USB flash drive in your bag and it could be a real lifesaver. And file transfer. You can use a decent, fast USB flash drive for image or video transfer when you're out in the field with your laptop. Then plug it into your desktop machine when you get back. It's just about the quickest and simplest way to swap files between computers. And I get this once in a while. People would say, hey, can you give me a copy of what you have on your system? This is like someone borrowing a cup of sugar. Yeah, I'll do it, but I'll put it on the cheap flash stick so that if it doesn't come back, I don't get disappointed. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Generator power.
The report I planned for tonight is getting bumped by a week. It's about coronavirus chemical warfare. In other words, the sprays and other wet stuff that gets sold to do surface disinfection. But tonight, I asked Hank to instead replay my report on residential electrical backup power generators, which is less about how they generate juice than about how a lot of resellers generate enormous revenues by bundling in things that can end up costing you more than the generator itself. So sit back and listen up. It all starts right after the music. Have you ever seen a vehicle that runs on natural gas? It's true for many city buses in many places and some delivery vehicles. So obviously it's not impossible to convert something like a car engine or a truck engine to run on natural gas or on liquid propane gas. And that's exactly what runs whole house backup generators. Now think about it. What might you expect that engine's maintenance requirements to be? Come on, that's not a trick question. It's the usual engine maintenance stuff. Changing the oil and the oil filter, replacing the air filter, making sure the battery that spins the starter is okay, and the solenoid that connects the battery to the starter. Occasional spark plug changes, maybe an occasional tune-up or double-check the timing. But remember, if that engine is running a backup generator, you're not putting a lot of miles on it. It might run every so often as part of a self-diagnostic, a self-test mode. That doesn't take much. And of course, it can just keep running through outages, which aren't generally more than, hours to days long. For most houses, a smaller air-cooled engine can handle everything. For mansions or places with huge power consumption, you may want to bump it up to a water-cooled engine, which also means attention to the radiator and to antifreeze. But overall, you're not looking at huge maintenance needs or huge maintenance costs. Still, many people who buy backup generators from the most heavily advertised brands can end up paying far more for the cost of a maintenance program, far beyond recommended. It's required, mandated in the purchase contract. And that's not the only gravy they'll be forever hitting you up to deliver. Of course, they'll tell you convincing stories about why it's a better value for you when those are included, and maybe some horror stories about real or imaginary people who ran into terrible trouble by breaking the contract and never again paying for those things. Hey, Brooklyn, sell me a bridge. Speaking of selling, the colder or stormier or otherwise more disruptive the weather, the hotter the season for those generator sellers. Because when blackouts happen, as they so often do, they hit most people totally by surprise. Not many people plan for an outage, and zap, no power. You can guess what emotions surround that. Anger, fear, frustration. That leads to thinking, I'll never let that happen to me again. and that leads to a lot of soft targets for those slick generator brand commercial and ad campaigns, which itself should raise a little yellow flag. If they're delivering a good value to their customers, how can they possibly afford that huge ad spend? The money has to come from somewhere, and spending it needs to be justified by some even larger amount as a return on the advertising investment. Can you feel their fingers reaching for your wallet? There you are, inconvenienced, vulnerable, looking for a way out of outages ever again bothering you. And there they are, talking about how they're somehow leaders in providing their answers. You'll only hear one brand name in this segment, and it's not the one that keeps demonstrating a need to feed the greed weed. We'll get there in a moment, but first, let's talk tech. How much power does your house need? Make that, how much power does your house need at any one time? Few homes, very few, use as much as 20 kVA. For simplicity's sake, and adjusting for a variable called power factor, that means 15 kilowatts of power, 20 kVA, 15 kilowatts. If you were to run absolutely everything electrical at the same time, you might push your usage past that. But it's not that hard to keep things sane. For example, if you have an all-electric HVAC system, an electric oven, an electric dryer, and an electrical outage going on, do you really need to dry clothes and bake a turkey at the same time? 20 kVA happens to be about the biggest load that a smaller air-cooled engine can run. Some of them do 20 kilowatts, which, as you know, is a little bigger because of power factor. A lot of them are 20 kVA. For the sake of simplicity, let's peg that 20 kVA as our desired capacity. What does it take to get a generator installed and running? That depends on the generator and the philosophy of the company selling and installing it. Here are some of the elements of an installation that get lost in the noise level when you start looking at generators. Outdoor concrete pads or other housing so the generator isn't just sitting on mud. A manual or automatic transfer switch so the generator automatically switches itself in and out of providing electricity as utility power disappears and reappears. A through-wall power connection. A connection to your load center, the breaker box, you know, that box with all the breakers in it. And they might try talking you into a load-shedding configuration that automatically disconnects selected power consumption items when the rest of the house starts drawing too much power. There might also be a charge for a special kit if you live anywhere where the temperature drops below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Each thing on that list adds hundreds to thousands of dollars to your bottom line price tag. And that's before they layer on those mandated annual service and support fees, separate layers for some of them. So, with some sellers, it's less like buying a product and more like funding somebody's unfriendly divorce settlement. Or so we're told. Judy and I are coming on to 42 years of a first marriage for both. After years of looking into residential generator makers and talking to them and grilling their people at trade shows and a lot of other homework, there's one that may deserve your attention. Disclaimer time. That one, they are not providing any payments or products or anything else to anybody here. This is based on investigation. None of us has any of their products installed or running. No money and no product passed in either direction informing this recommendation. It's just earned. The company is Cummins, C-U-M-M-I-N-S, Cummins. It's their model RS20AC. Letter R is in Romeo, letter S is in Sugar. Number 2, number 0. Letter A is in Able, letter C is in Charlie. RS20AC. It includes a 20 kilowatt generator and a 200 amp service entrance automatic transfer switch. The options you may want to consider include an outdoor mounting pad and an extreme cold weather kit. But do your own homework. Find dealers for any brand, every brand that interests you. Ask smart questions. If it's a 20-kilowatt residential backup power generator with an automatic transfer switch, an outdoor pad, and a cold weather kit, find out what the bottom line price is for each of those sellers to do the full installation. Remember, that could involve feeding a gas line through a basement wall. That bottom line should include all the parts and all the installation charges. And make very sure to ask about what ongoing commitments are riding along that will cost you more money every year just to keep it running. That's called TCO, short for Total Cost of Ownership. And total must mean total. Then make your best choice. Next time, there are still so many questions and there's still so much misunderstanding about UVC that it seemed appropriate to get back to basics and help make understanding hard ultraviolet a little easier. Join us for our UVC primer, because when you're not confused, you're much less likely to get bamboozled.
Thank you, Marty. Coming up March the 20th, the 45th Trenton Computer Festival. It is the original personal computer festival. The Trenton Computer Festival, TCF, was created back in 1976 as an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, an exhibit area, as well as an outdoor flea market. But with the pandemic, all that got changed. TCF 2021 will be held as a virtual event on Saturday, March the 20th, 2021. It will be a full day of learning and fun. TCF 21 is free via Zoom teleconferencing to all. Donations will be welcome and accepted to offset expenses. All you need is a personal computing device, like a personal computer, a tablet, and maybe perhaps a little difficulty, even a smartphone. The TCF keynote speaker will be Jerry Foster, and he will be talking about how I learned to stop worrying and love artificial intelligence. He is the CTO and co-founder of Plex Systems. This keynote provides an overview of artificial intelligence from its humble beginnings to disruptive force, with an eye towards the significant positive impact on our world. The website for the festival is tcf-nj.org for more information. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, March the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, March the 12th, 2001, 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, March the 25th, 2021. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom. Their website is pcug.com. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. For most of the country, this is a reminder that we will move the clock forwards 1 hour to daylight savings times this weekend. So, it should be same time minus 1 hour, same station next week.